Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
With every episode, I have been opening with circus references, but I want to take you back a step for this particular episode on culture and divorce. I want to take you back to how I got to join the circus and why I use circus references when I open this podcast. When I was in college, I was preparing to be a musician. I had done that since I was 10 years old, performed everywhere, classically trained musician. But then when I got to college, I realized in my second year that the talent required on a larger scale to earn a living playing music was more than I had. So my father sat me down and we had a talk. And he said, look, I'll support you in any way you want to go, but do you have any idea what you want to do from this point forward? Because I started majoring in things that I had interest in, journalism, communications, things like that. And I was silent for a second. And I honestly don't know where this answer came from. I think it came from the universe, however we want to interpret that. Here was my answer. I don't, Dad, know the exact job or area of work that I want to go into, but here's what I do know. I want to work with as many cultures of people humanly possible in the world and in as many places in the world possible too. And that's all I know. And he went with me. That was in the early 70s. I'm ancient. Fast forward to 1980. Now, I had worked, I graduated from school, had jobs, but you know, you just have jobs until you really land where you want to land. I was reading an ad in the newspaper, Pittsburgh Press, that said, circus, circus, see the country. And it listed everything I majored in. Marketing, communications, entertainment, literature, because you had to write. And so I made an aesthetic goal. Now, when I went to the circus, it was a dream come true. I worked with so many different cultures. I learned about people's religions and how they live their daily lives. And it was a multicultural environment that actually got along. Life and death actually held us together because it was a three-ring circus of high wire acts, animal acts, and everybody had to cooperate with each other in order to do their jobs, so we were engaged with each other. Therefore, we had to get along. Now you fast forward even more to 9 years ago when I started working in family law, divorce, which is in Los Angeles a multicultural experience, one of the most multicultural cities in the country. And if anybody has not traveled throughout the United States, even if you're looking at just the Caucasian environment of the United States, each state and each city are very different from one another. So not all Caucasians think alike and behave alike. This starts our discussion today. I have been wanting to do an episode on culture and divorce for a while, and I finally met the woman that I wanted to bring to you, the person I wanted to bring to you, in the body of a woman. I met Dr. Manajay Dhanishpour, and thank you, by the way, doctor, for joining us on this program.
You're welcome.
I met her at this networking event, the Los Angeles Marriage and Family Therapist. I belonged to them for 9 years, ever since I started in the divorce business, and I have met the most brilliant people giving lectures. And Dr., may I just call you Dr. Manajay?
Of course.
Thank you.
The majority of people call me Dr. Manajay. So.
Okay, good. So, Dr. Manajay, you were so great when you made the presentation, and it was just on a larger topic of culture and diversity and how it's important to understand. But now we're going to focus on divorce because of your credentials. So you are in Orange County. You are distinguished professor of marriage and family therapy at Allient International University, the couple and family therapy program. So perfect for our discussion on divorce. Here's the story I want to start with, and I would love for you to comment on this. I work as a mediator for the Los Angeles County Bar Association in their attorney-client fee mediation program, which means when clients hire attorneys and at some point along the way they have a discrepancy, a disagreement about what the charges are, or for some reason the client hasn't paid the attorney, they land in my office and we discuss what the issue is, and I mediate the fee dispute, and somehow we generally come to a conclusion. Fascinating story a few years ago between an Armenian father and an Iranian attorney. The Armenian father was in the court system for years because it was an extensive child custody issue, to the extent where there were child custody evaluators, minors counsel for the children. I think there were three children, more than two children. The kids were getting older as the case was going on. The Armenian father went through eight attorneys. And you can see every attorney listed on the case profile until he hired his ninth attorney, the Iranian lawyer. It was a minor fee dispute. It was under $1,000, which is in the big scheme of lawyer fees, as everybody would think, very small. I don't know why I asked this question to start the mediation, but I asked to the Armenian father, why did you hire this particular lawyer as your ninth lawyer? And the answer was simple, because he understands my culture. We are very similar. And one of the examples the father gave was, I am getting misunderstood by opposing counsel and all these evaluators. Because when I speak to my children, when I have them with me, it's traditionally over a meal. This is where my discussions take place. And he said, in my culture, this is what we do. We have important discussions over meals. And the accusation, charges coming back were, I force feed my children. The Iranian lawyer was shocked. It changed the whole dynamic of the conversation now that he understood. And he had represented the man for a while. Dr. Manage, can you please comment on this in any way you think important?
What if, first of all, thank you so much, Judith, for having this very important conversation, because marriage and divorce are basically are so connected to family life everywhere in every culture. And so connections are important. Disconnections are important as well. So I appreciate having this conversation with you. Such a fascinating story that is part of my professional life. It seems like on a daily basis that something is misunderstood between two people, two groups of people, couples, families. And so what you see here is when the Armenian client says, because he understood my culture, that means there was a validation for him after eight or nine lawyers about his way of doing things as opposed to pathologizing that. So we have to start with the definition of what culture is. Culture is a way that we have a set of belief systems. It may be language involved. It may be food involved. But mostly is about a sense of identity that people have. And contrary to popular belief, cultures are not static. You don't have an Iranian culture or Caucasian culture and is the same, stays the same from your childhood until you die. It's very dynamic. It's very context dependent. And so what happened between the Armenian client and the lawyer was that the lawyer was able to look at the same story from a different perspective. So the lawyer was able to not pathologize what happened and how people viewed him having food with his children. And so later on, we may want to talk about that and open it up a little bit more about culture and how it's viewed in the American context and how we can work with it to make it something that it adds to our understanding as opposed to being used for stereotypes.
I think you should do it right now. That was one of the questions I was going to segue into. Since we are a multicultural country, like it or not, here we are. That has always been the perspective. We wanted to build on that. Now here we are. Why is it important to understand each other's culture?
Because culture is not a country's phenomena. It's as personal as getting up in the morning and getting ready for your day based on your personal culture of this is how I start my day. Some people make their beds. Some people don't make their beds. Some people go for a walk. Some people have breakfast first. So that's a personal culture. So we have
or
to start
or prayer that. First, right?
Or prayers first. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so we start from there saying that we have personal cultures, personal characteristics that will tell us that this is how I want to live my life. Then we have family culture that we in family appropriation, we create our culture. If we have a healthy relationship, right, we learn from our partner about what works and what doesn't work. And we realize that what worked in our family of origin may not work in the family appropriation. So that's another layer of culture, that we have family of origin culture. We learned how to spend money. We learned how to relate to people. We learned how to be loved and what gets us attention. And then when we create our own family, that changes because the other person also had a family culture. And then we have this neighborhood culture where we grew up. If we were poor, if we were middle class, if we were upper class, in my practice, I've seen way more in common between upper class Iranian, for example, and upper class Caucasian people. They have so much in common, more than their culture of origin in terms of being Caucasian or being Arab or being Iranian. So then we have the religious and belief value culture, that if you belong to a Christian family as opposed to a Jewish family, as opposed to a Buddhist family, as opposed to Hindu families, we have different kinds of cultures that come with it that will intertwine with everyday life. And then we have the before I get to the nation's cultures, based on the collectivistic and individualistic cultures, I have to get into the colonial culture, that majority, 90% of the nations of the globe were colonized by Caucasian men, white men. And that impacted the history for at least for the past 500 years, history of all of our cultures and how we relate to each other and what we value and what we don't value and how we relate to each other and who's right, whose culture is inferior, whose culture is superior. And so that's the part that is very important, that when we think about culture, number one, it's not static. It's dynamic and it's changing. And number two, there are so many factors play into it. The other danger that we have is that people use this static definition of culture to either justify their own behavior or justify other people's behavior. It's like, you know, many of my students, because I teach a multicultural family therapy course, and people go, so if somebody comes to me and says, I'm hitting my child because that is not prohibited in my culture. In my culture, we hit our children to discipline them, right? And people go, so what should I do? If I'm multiculturally sensitive, I should say, okay, you can hit your child. And my answer to that is that if hitting a child cross-culturally beyond borders of any country is wrong, then you should go with that definition of the global culture that we have proven, research has proven that hitting another person does not get them to comply forever. It quiets them for the time being, but number one, teaches them that they can use the same kind of force when they have power. And number two is that this person cannot reason with me and therefore uses hitting to get rid of his own or her own anger. And so that's how you deal with culture. You don't stay with, well, in my culture, it's okay. And so because the students and newcomers, therapists and perhaps lawyers and perhaps people in other fields get so nervous about somebody because they want to be multiculturally sensitive when somebody says, in my culture. Well, what about other people in your culture? So everybody wakes up in the morning in your culture and hits their children so they behave? Or there are variations. And so there are ways that we can work with this dynamic aspects of culture that could be very helpful to any of us professionals in the field.
So two things. I really did want you to talk about at some point today how professionals in the divorce arena, therapists, mediators like myself, lawyers, anybody, child custody evaluators, why is it important for them to be aware of whatever the basic aspects of culture are with their clients so that they can provide appropriate services that are helpful?
Yes. So because we identify who we are is under the umbrella of cultural aspects of who we are. So that's important for us to have an understanding of our clients' culture. But again, that it is very important not to be hierarchical in that sense, that because we have so much power as lawyers, as therapists, as healers, and as doctors, as teachers, as judges, we have so much power. And what happens is people use that it must be cultural, not in a way to understand what's going on with the person and help them from that aspect. Usually it gets used for, oh, okay, so your culture is inferior to mine. And it's very, very unconscious. I want to share with you a personal story. A few years ago, my husband's younger brother, much younger than him, in his 30s, got drowned in Lake Tahoe. And was very tragic because they couldn't find his body. And for whatever reason, the whole family thought that he didn't drown. He's somewhere and he's going to walk into somebody's home one of these days. And it took 13 days to find his body. So was very tragic for my husband, who had other losses along the way. So after this loss, he's a very touchy-feely, let's talk about everything. He wasn't talking. He wasn't connecting. He had a very hard time even functioning on a daily basis. And so after a while, I told him, please go see someone. You're not doing well. And he wasn't willing to. He was like, no, I'm fine. If you guys just leave me alone, I'm going to be fine. So finally, I decided that our relationship is very much at stake because I feel this is not good for our relationship, for our kids. So because I lived in Minnesota and I needed to find someone that didn't know me because I am a lecturer, I'm a presenter. Majority of people I was on the board of regulatory board of marriage and family therapy. Everybody and their mother almost knew me in the field of family therapy. So I'm like, I can't go to a family therapist. So I found this very seasoned, much older person who was not part of the marriage and family therapy field, was part of another field, was a social worker, and actually went in and decided that let's go and see her. So I'm thinking, and the reason I mentioned this part of the story is important because it impacts what happened later. So when we go to her office, first session, talking about what's going on in our relationship, she looks at my husband and goes, how does it feel to be married to the god of family therapy? And I'm like, oh no. Now this is not a compliment. And it wasn't a compliment to me. It created a hierarchy between the therapist, who was a white woman, and my husband, who is a person of color, supposedly, right? Iranians are considered, even though they be considered white, people don't recognize that as white. Right. So right away, is within the first 5 minutes of the session, she's putting him down, maybe consciously, maybe unconsciously, but that he said, oh, I am so proud of her. All my life, I have believed, and he does, that women are not being recognized for their power, for their strengths in any cultures. And so I'm very happy that my wife is so successful. So that ends, right? Fast forward 6-7 sessions later, so it wasn't early in our relationship. We were talking about him not being able to process his grief. So I told the therapist, who specializes in grief, right? I said, this is a sentence I said. I said, I feel incredibly helpless to get my husband out of this rut that he's in. And no matter how much I try, he is just sitting in there, right? And I'm crying and really being vulnerable. And it's very hard for me to be vulnerable because all my professional life, I had to be in the position of power in relations to other people. So vulnerability is something very difficult for me. So I'm crying and saying I am helpless. So I use the word, I feel helpless, which in any context should make sense, right? You can't help another person. So she looks at me and she goes, isn't that cultural?
Oh my.
So I froze. I said, what do you mean? He says, you know, Iranian culture, women are oppressed, men are in control.
Oh my.
So I froze. and when we left the session, I said, I can't believe she said that. And my husband jokingly, he said, oh, really? Now you got offended 8 sessions later? She offended me within the first 5 minutes that we walked into her office, but you didn't pay any attention to that part because it wasn't about you. She called you the god of family therapist, which I noticed at the time. And so we walked away from that, the work that we were doing together. And I've been talking about this episode in many of my national, international presentations about how culture gets used. So 99% of the time, culture gets used to tell someone you are inferior. And the white culture, because of that 500 years of colonial, we are better than you. We have a superior culture. We have to tell you how to run your lives. It's so unconsciously embedded in relationships with white people, regardless of their class. You can be a working class white person and you still feel superior to a professional person of color that is educated, that has class, that has culture, that has everything. And so that's the part of culture that I think we need to, when we talk about why is it important to think about culture, it is very important, but it has to be used appropriately and not in a hierarchical sense.
Do you think, in your experiences, that the Caucasian culture looks at culture as one giant other? So there's the Caucasian culture, that's me, kind of, that's me. And then there's everybody else and they're all in this one big pot of other.
Yes. Yes, very much. And that becomes, and then when we challenge white people and say, first of all, I tell my white students that you have culture too. And you really need, in order for you to understand my culture, you need to understand your culture. And you need to connect with it. You need to embrace your cultural values if you want to help me embrace my cultural values. And so in people in position of power, as lawyers and doctors and professionals, when they are white, or they can pass as white, because there are many people who, if you don't know, because I told you that the northern part of Iran, if they come to the U.S., you wouldn't know. If they don't open their mouth and they don't have an accent, you wouldn't know that they are from Iran, and in because they can pass.
Because they're blonde hair. You were saying this, I didn't know it. They're blonde haired, blue eyes,
exactly. And so you wouldn't know, right? But even those blonde hair, blue eyed people have learned over 500 years, which are generations of colonized countries, that they are less than white people. And white people, by definition of who we call American, we don't call Mexicans and Afghanis that have been here for generations American. When people say, is your friend American? They mean, are they white and belong to this American definition of who belongs to this group. And so it becomes muddy in all of our relationships with our clients, with our students, with people in the court system, that where they belong and how they define themselves.
You know, I, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, if a person born in America, a Caucasian, mm-hmm. were to be asked, can you define your culture? Mm-hmm. I wonder how we would define it. I've never been asked.
Well, for 25 years, I'm teaching a multicultural family therapy class. And I asked this students of my white Caucasian students that, what is your culture? Let's talk about that. And they are always like, I don't know. Why does that matter? I asked this question. I have them write an essay about what does it mean to be white. Majority of students have a hard time, and if they want to go there, they have to become really vulnerable. And there are times that they become really vulnerable and go, oh my gosh, I never thought about my position in the universe. The past 500 years universe, it may change. We may have a different group of people 500 years from now, mm-hmm. that are in we have the imperialism belonging to them, right? We don't know. But for now, for what we are experiencing in our lifetime, majority of white people are the reference. The way they do divorce, the way they relate to their children, the way they handle things, everything is a reference for the rest of us. And if we're not doing it that way, then we are doing it wrong. Lawyers reinforce that, therapists reinforce that, judges reinforce that. It's like there is, oh, you're eating with your children, you must be overfeeding them.
Why are you forcing them to have a meal with you every time you want to have a discussion?
Exactly. So it becomes, they pathologize.
Right.
Because it doesn't fit into. I was at an international conference, and a man, I was talking about culture, and he got up and he said, I'm working with this 27-year-old Pakistani woman who is a lawyer, lives in New York. His parents live in Midwest somewhere in the U.S. And because she's recently divorced, she's asking her parents, she's so sad, she's asking her parents to call her every morning and wake her up and you know, just kind of starting her day. And he said, at what point should I tell this woman that your behavior is not okay? And I'm like, at no point. Why is her behavior not okay? Why do you have to correct that behavior? And this is a guy who is attending a multicultural therapy training, right? So that means already, hopefully, you know, he is thinking about culture. And I'm like, what makes you, why are you pathologizing? Somebody is depressed. And within the context of a failed relationship, And so she's asking her parents to call her every morning. Who are you to decide that that is not an appropriate behavior? Unless she comes to you and says, hey, I really don't like the fact that my parents call me every morning.
Yeah.
Can you please help me not have this? Who gets to decide what behavior is appropriate and what behavior is not appropriate? Based on whose culture? How are we defining if people are not coming to us and saying, can you please help me with this situation? I have worked with many women, white women in the U.S. in the process of divorce with their Middle Eastern, African spouse. So when it gets to mediation, when it gets to the process of divorce, they're using every aspect of their partner's life and pathologize them. And then take it to the judge, take it to the court, mm-hmm. like you have the best example, right? And the system goes with that pathologizing, right?
Yeah.
I was part of a session with an Iranian man that was married to an American woman. He decided, very unfortunate, he decided to commit suicide, and they had a 5-year-old. And he took his son to the garage and turned on the car, which was very, very dangerous. And so they, nothing happened. Wife found them and she took full custody of the child and for 10 years didn't allow him to see his son. Okay. And said, you're dangerous, this and that. Now, 10 years later, I'm in the session with a co-therapist who's supposed to work with him to evaluate him. He's a white man. He says, manager, why don't you join me? He's Iranian. I want to be culturally sensitive, right? So first of all, the guy, the Iranian guy, didn't want me there, understandably. He's like, I'm getting evaluated. I don't need any culturally sensitive situation in the middle of my situation. So we sit there. The guy has a Samsonite full of documents that he has received depression treatment, that he has been done for years with his depression treatment. Now his son is getting older. He wants to have a relationship with him. And the wife 10 years later said he's Iranian, he's dangerous. Okay. And so there are no indications. He's a professional. He has a home. He has been no DUI, nothing, right? He has stacks of papers for this guy. So the first question my colleague asks this guy is that, can you tell me about your family of origin? He says, well, my dad was a merchant, rug merchant, very wealthy. And I have a brother, you know, something to that effect about his family. He goes, so did your dad beat up your mom? And he goes, no, never. He goes, are you sure? Are you like covering something for your family or? And just goes, and the guy gets more and more and more defensive, right? It's like, why are you talking about my parents who have been dead for years? And I do not remember my dad hitting my mom. Right? And he got more defensive. As he got more defensive, it got more heated, right? And he goes, oh, is that how you're going to be when you get upset? I'm like, I'm here, sitting here, a therapist. I'm upset when you want to break your neck. Why are you doing this to him? So when the session ended, I was like, what were you thinking? He goes, well, you know, an Iranian man, Middle Eastern, you know. You know your men, right? So it's like what I'm writing a book right now on gender, power, and social justice and how psychotherapy can help. I'm on chapter 5, which talks about the impact of colonizations on the concept of gender. I am so mad as I am reading all these different articles and books and looking at what has happened to us and to the concept of gender and how women have been viewed in a colonized way of thinking, and how men of color have been pathologized just because they're men of color, based on nothing they have done. All the atrocities that white men have done to their countries, all the resources that have been taken away, all the violence that have been part of these occupations for the last 500 years, none of them we talk about. None of them. It's like, oh, your woman covered, you must be oppressing your woman. Your woman should take off their hijab. They should look this way. You should be treating them this way and that way. And so these are the kind of things that divorce lawyers and therapists and judges have to pay attention to, that how their thinking is really dangerous in how they treat people of color, especially men in the court system, when they belong to these cultures and their wives are white, because it's always protecting white women, right? And in the process, they have oppressed them as well. I mean, why do we have feminist movements in Western countries? It didn't start from Egypt. It started from European countries going, enough is enough. Please don't treat me this way.
Right. Well, I have a few comments on this, because that was a lot. That was a lot of important things that you said. So as a mediator, various people come through my office, and I always ask what their culture is for this reason. I want to be able to understand what I'm going to be listening to. Mm-hmm. I grew up in an Italian household. So Weigel is my married name. I never got rid of it once I got divorced. And it's German and Welsh. It's not Jewish. And everybody thinks I'm Jewish, but I'm not Jewish. German and Welsh, married name. And it's just too hard to change back sometimes when you get divorced. When I have some of what we consider to be the more emotionally outspoken cultures. And I'm thinking of two specifically, because it happened in my office twice. Brazilians and Italians. Well, I'm really versed on how Italians talk. So every Sunday, my parents took us, my siblings and I, across town to have dinner with my aunt and uncles. In the Italian culture, if you did not get married, you stayed at home. Mm-hmm. So the household that my mother grew up in had two brothers who never got married, and a sister who got married, but her husband died shortly into the marriage. So three adults were living together, siblings. At the dinner table, there would be very high-pitched emotional dialogue. And so the first time I had this Italian couple in, it was like Sunday dinner. It didn't faze me. I was used to it, and they were Italian. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of waited till I felt they were evolving out of that particular point in the conversation, and they wound down and were calmer, and then we moved on, and I didn't make a big deal out of it. And the same thing happened with this Brazilian couple. And when they were done, they looked at me and they said, okay, Judy, we're ready to move on, as if nothing had happened. Now, we are taught in mediation, mm-hmm, not to let arguing go on for too long. Mm-hmm. Keep everything calm, keep everything quiet. And I'm like, but that's not how people express themselves. And as long as I can have a sense that this is the way it is, and they're going to work their way out of that and come into another dynamic, mm-hmm, I'm not going to say anything.
Good for you.
I'm going to let them be who they are. So let's go back to, as professionals in the divorce arena, before we hit the courtroom, if we have to hit the courtroom, that's a whole nother issue, hitting the courtroom with the judge. And I'll tell you an interesting story about that. Is it okay? And if it's not, tell me how to remedy this idea. Is it okay that we open up the discussion of their culture as we're providing our service to them? Or is that insensitive? Is there some other way we should acquaint ourselves with the way they express themselves in their cultures?
So culture is not something that people wear every morning and go out. It's very unconscious. And there are times that we ask people, can you tell me a little bit about your culture? And they go, what do you mean? I don't know what you want from me. They don't. It's not something that people are consciously aware of. And so there are times that we start talking about culture and people go, this has nothing to do with culture. I'm getting a divorce. Please help me with mediation and let's get it over with. There are other times that people bring up an aspect of culture. Like I told you, I hit my kid because it's not sanctioned in my culture. And then we get into it. So it's a combination of when we should approach it, should we approach it, should we allow clients to approach it. So it's a combination. There is no formula that we say, okay, when they come to your office, 20 minutes into the conversation, say something about culture. It comes up as we are having conversations. What I do, because I am from another culture, and I look different because I'm a Middle Eastern woman and I wear hijab. What I do in first session, as soon as 90% of my clients are white, Caucasian, belong to this culture. So what I do, I talk about my culture. I say, before we say anything, before we start this conversation, let me tell you a little bit about me so you can make a decision if you feel comfortable with this relationship. And if not, I can always refer you to other people. So I open that conversation. I talk about being a woman. I talk about being from Middle Eastern. I talk about I'm not wearing hijab because I am religious. I'm wearing it to make a point about not every professional should look like mainstream white and in the hegemony, the discourse that has been used to define professionals. I don't want to fit into them. And so I'm challenging that status quo, that way of defining women and culture. So I'll bring it up. And then I say, if you have any questions, if you feel comfortable, uncomfortable, if something comes up related to culture and religion and women and relationships, I'm more than happy to discuss that. So I put people at ease at the beginning, like get to know me a little bit so you know who you're dealing with, and then we will go from there. And so that has been working in my relationship with clients. I remember one time there were this white couple. I was challenging the husband, session 5, 6, something like that. And the husband looks at me and goes, I'm so confused. I chose you because I thought you're a Middle Eastern woman and you don't know about your own rights. So you're going to help me actually be, telling my wife what to do. And then you are challenging me about, you know, fairness and justice in relationships, and you are on my wife's. So he was just kind of dissing me, right? Saying that that's what I think about you. But that was excellent. Right? Because it brought to the surface what he was thinking about someone like me. And at the same time, thinking that only white people treat their wives well, which they don't. We all know. But that has been the stereotype that women of color think that they are happily married if they marry a white guy. And so I bring up culture. And then keep it open in the conversation. But there are times that people look at you and say, that has nothing to do with why I'm here. And therefore, if we do it, if we talk about culture, then we are imposing our values, and that's not okay.
All right. So I have another example then of how I did it. Because I go every July, it's probably going to be the ninth year, to a seminar presented by the Iranian Lawyers Association. They have advanced what we call this cultural diversity seminar to show the prejudices that exist within the legal community. And there are some therapists that are there. I may be the only non-attorney mediator in the room. For some reason, I don't think this has gone beyond the legal community, except for a few fringe therapists and me as a non-attorney mediator. But it's to make us all better at our jobs to, A, underscore the prejudices we may all have going into our jobs and servicing our clients, and how we could hurt them by not understanding that we're not understanding them. So after one of these seminars, one in July, I had a young Japanese woman call me, Judy, I want to get divorced. Can you file for me? Maybe we'll need mediation, maybe not, but you know, tell me more about how you do this. So I did, and then I said to her, is there anything about your culture that I need to know in order to look at how you two may be creating your settlement terms, in order to just be prepared for something a little different than the way it's typically done in law here in California? And she said, well, yes, thank you for asking. So I really took a chance by asking her, hoping she wasn't going to get offended, and she didn't. And she said, well, there's a couple things in the Japanese culture that are important, and they may be part of our settlement agreement. They may not. Let's see how it works out. The first thing is, the person who has perpetrated the divorce is the one who essentially gets nothing. Mm-hmm. They must give everything away to the other person. It's an issue of honor. And she said, I'm unfortunately the one that perpetrated the divorce. I've had a child by another man. And so, you know, I will give him whatever he asks for in that case, and I'm not going to be asking for child support. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And she said, also, when there's a divorce in the Japanese culture, and I really hope I'm remembering this right, when there's a divorce in the Japanese culture, the families are literally separated and you don't get to see your grandparents on the other side. And she said, unfortunately, my soon-to-be ex-husband is working in our family business and he's not going to be working there any longer. It's literally going to end the way he makes a living. So I found that fascinating. Now, none of that worked out, by the way. They actually adhered to whatever California law is in child support, custody, and although I guess he didn't, the husband didn't want to continue to work in the family business. I think that's kind of obvious. Yeah. It would be uncomfortable. But I learned. I had no idea. And I learned.
That was the best way to approach the matter of culture, to say, is there anything about cultural that I need to know? And then you keep it open-ended because the person can decide what is it. They can go with family culture, right? They can go with their church culture or the synagogue culture. They can go with the way that the in-laws are defining their relationship. It could go anywhere. It doesn't always have to go with the big Japanese culture per se. It can go into many different layers. And in Japanese culture can be an overarching perspective over it all. So perfect way of approaching people in Japanese culture.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a safe way too, because then you give the power to the other person to you, and then you put yourself in a learning situation. Whatever they want to teach you is fine. Instead of reading up and making assumptions that this is how you're going to behave because I read that these are aspects of your country of origin, maybe yes. Three generations ago, who knows? Maybe you've never even been there.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is how you say you identify. Okay, now this is fascinating because you brought it up and I wanted to make this a point. In this cultural diversity understanding biases seminar that I attend once a year, at noon, there's a whole panel of judges. There's about, I don't know, 8 to 13 judges, all in family law. And it's all about the judges becoming vulnerable and saying to all these lawyers who try their cases in front of these judges where the judges' biases are and what they are working on to keep them contained, so to speak, so that it doesn't spill out in their rulings. I that
How
was
fascinating. How important.
because judges are tough. I mean, they've got power. Not that you can't question it and try and modify their rulings, because you can. There's an option. But they have power and people are afraid. Even men, still in this day, when there are minor children, men are afraid the children will be taken away. And even when I say, well, at least in the California court system, in Southern California, the best interest of the child prevail, and the starting point is, if there's nothing wrong with either parent, if there's no drug addiction or anger management or, you know, something that would be harmful to the child when that parent is alone with the child, the starting point is 50-50 timeshare. And from that point forward, parents, is this workable? Is this not workable? Why? Look at your schedules. And then you go from there. But the men are still very fearful.
Very much. Understandably, because it has been, the law has not favored them and listened to them and valued them. Men of color are not valued, even by other men of color in power.
So we haven't really talked about religion, which is, religion is part of the cultural makeup of a country. And the one example that comes to mind is the Jewish get. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know if, do you deal with that in the Iranian culture, the Jewish get? Because there are Jewish
communities. Yeah, for Jewish communities, we deal with that. But for Muslims, there is another way of looking at it. So in each religious community, be Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, Muslim, there are religious aspects of being divorced.
So, yes. Now, when you're working out the settlement, mediator or attorney, and maybe even a therapist is there for a consulting, emotionally consulting aspect of the settlement, you know, we have a separation of church and state. You know, that's our big thing in the United States, separation of church and state. So if there's something in the religious aspect of your culture that may not comport with the civil aspect of getting divorced, do you have any suggestions or guidelines for how people should deal with this? Or do you have any examples of how a Muslim would deal with this? And what would be something that would come out of that religion that may be part of a divorce settlement?
Mm-hmm. There are so many aspects of religious values that will impact people. There are people that are not practicing, in any religion. All of a sudden, when divorce happens, and then they're practicing. They go, well, based on my religion, it's like we're not practicing any other aspects of it. And all of a sudden, you think it's your best interest to not. For example, in Islamic culture, you have to do this. Clergy has to announce and you divorced, so you can go your separate ways. But the man has to maintain his wife for the next 4 months completely financially, because she may be pregnant. So that 4 months is for a period that you make sure that the wife is not pregnant, because there are other rights that come with it. For the most part, at least in my personal practice, I've stayed away from those aspects of it, because it gets so muddy and people use us in justifying whatever is part of their religious culture. So I have, cultural background or family culture. And so I personally stay away from those and say, you need to talk to your imam, your church leader. I had a student that her husband was having an affair, and another colleague of mine at the university was very conservatively Christian. She went to him and said, my husband is having an affair. I'm thinking of divorce. And he said to her, well, I wonder what you did that your husband is having an affair on you. And God doesn't look doesn't favor you in this situation and favors your husband. Now, that's what she was telling me. I didn't have a conversation with him. And so even in that context, I was like, this is something that I cannot get into, because cross-culturally, when people are struggling and they need help, they go to the religious leaders of their faith, whatever that faith is. They don't come to us. And so they start from there. And then if everything gets really muddy and bad and doesn't get resolved, they come to us to save the relationship. And if that doesn't work, they come to you for divorce and they start the process. So I stay away from that aspect of culture, even though I ask clients to explain how that impacts their relationship.
Well, I understand that. I understand, because yes, it is very complicated, and you know, we all get emotional when we're discussing each other's religions, and mm-hmm. my religion is righter than your religion. Definitely. It's always the way it's been. Yeah. But when I'm dealing with Orthodox Jewish people as a mediator and somebody who's filing and writing their settlement agreement, mm-hmm. I had to learn all the holidays. I had to learn all the rules, because they do want them in the settlement agreement, mm-hmm. and that's fine. So in the co-parenting settlement, the portion of the settlement agreement, I know that in Los Angeles, people who are Orthodox are not going to be driving from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. Okay. Now, I had a couple where he was Orthodox and she was just conservative. So she didn't go to that extreme, and she didn't only go to kosher restaurants where there's a little basin, you wash your hands, you know, for the cleanliness and the respect that you give the food and the process of eating together communal. So the deal was, for 2 years, she agreed to live in walking distance from her soon-to-be ex-husband, mm-hmm. so that their two children mm-hmm. could walk back and forth, yep. Shabbat dinner Friday night, yep. to the temple, you know, yep. and wherever else they wanted to go. But after 2 years, she reserved the right to move mm-hmm. out only in driving distance, yep. and they would have to restructure the co-parenting schedule. Mm-hmm. She wasn't expecting him to change his religion or change how he dealt with his religion, but she didn't want to change either. So mm-hmm. that was the compromise that they mm-hmm. had reached. And they haven't hit the 2 year part now. So I really don't know how this is
what's going to happen after. Yeah. Yeah.
But at least for the time being, that's what they mm-hmm. did. Mm-hmm. So let's end on this note. One last exploration into how we can connect and make all of this work. How do we position ourselves, and I'll say in the divorce arena, because I want to stick with divorce, anybody servicing their clients and people dealing with each other going through divorce, how can we connect through culture and religion rather than disconnect?
One word, respect and understanding. Not having this hierarchical, somehow, some way, I'm superior than you. It's you, and have the curiosity to know about other groups of people, and in without judgment, without prejudice, without discrimination, just pure curiosity, knowing that humans have made life work in different parts of the globe, one way or another, and they're going to continue to do so. It's just that when we come together from different cultures and different groups, how do we have a equal, respectful, and a non-hierarchical relationship, and just understand each other, respect each other, and believe that people have the right to be dignified in all everything that happens through the divorce process, through the mediation process, everything that happens, people and their dignity should be respected.
I love that. Thank you. That was such a good note to end on. I appreciate it. Dr. Manishay Danishpour, how would people get in touch with you for any reason, for therapy, to attend any of your programs, classes, read anything you've written? How do they connect with you?
So if people just Google my name,
which will be in the show notes, you'll see how it's written.
Yeah, they can find all kinds of things. I have a website called drmanager-for-one-word.com, and they can go and find out about my services, who I am, what I'm all about. And there are a list of my papers, and get an introduction to my book. There are all kinds of things they can find in my website. But the easiest thing to do is to just Google my name, and a bunch of things will come up, and they can look at it. There are different podcasts that they can listen to. There are different presentations that have been taped, and it's on Google. So Google my name, basically, and you can have access to
Google's my best friend.
Yeah, there you go. Mine too. Everybody's, I guess.
Thank you, Dr. Manager. This was absolutely a pleasure, and it was what I was looking forward to, with the right person to have this conversation with. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Appreciate it.
And thank all of you for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you. Please share this episode with anybody that you feel needs it, which is, I think, everybody, divorcing or not divorcing, shed some light on our understanding of culture. If you would like to ask me any questions, suggest any topics for me, you can reach me through my website, theamicabledivorceexpert.com, theamicabledivorceexpert.com. And as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.